Salmon Island Prevention Coalition, Senator Stark Wickman, is yet here again to present to us by invitation. Cynthia, stage is yours, ma'am.
Yes, thank you. First, I want to extend my gratitude to all of the commissioners for the work that you do and entertaining support to the Prevention Coalition. I hope I have some dendrites left to speak for the next few minutes after all that information that Beth just provided you with. I think our organizations will be working together more and more as we're working more and more with EMS as partners. So again, I want to thank you for whatever support you have given us over the past 2 years and the potential for moving forward. Not doing the PowerPoint, but I gave you a most updated PowerPoint. Our county's system was several programs on the server were updated last Thursday night.
Yes.
And I am in an outlier building that we leased to Compass Health, so I'm kind of last on the fix-it list. So I've been without email. And all my files are on the server, so I wasn't even able to really pull up the current PowerPoint to edit it consistently. But this morning, I was able to get in and did what I could in editing mode. So the main thing I want to say to you is that, excitedly, we have moved in our prevention work from always talking about youth alcohol, tobacco, marijuana, other drug use, and just talking about drug use, preventing and reducing youth substance use. Over the last 4 years, as a nation and as a state, we have shifted it more into a proactive focus on what we are promoting is wellness and mental health, knowing that youth substance use typically is an outcome, more a self-medicating action as a result to anxiety stressors going on in young people's lives. So the resources have become more combined around substance abuse prevention and mental health promotion, and we're able to talk more proactively about it. And this links very beautifully with the work that the hospital is doing in integrating healthcare, is that when we work with youth, we are always working with them in curriculum. They may call it the triangle of health, so physical health, mental health, and behavioral health, with the behavioral health piece being very critical to the work that we do in substance abuse prevention. So the PowerPoint that Pamela and Nathan now have actually has notes to several of the slides. So you have it in a PDF format and also in the PowerPoint format. And if you go into the notes part of it, you can get some of the narrative that's just some of my thinking as I was working on the slides. Because it's not only for you, but for our Healthy Youth Survey 2018 work group. The data came out in April. It takes us about a month of a full-time person downloading all that data into the various reports. We are probably working with over 5,000 data points in grades 6 through 12, so we are very much still in process. But what I wanted to do and have been able to do in this report is give you some of the 2018 results that have not gone public to the school district who owns the data, or to our coalition who makes recommendations from that. So just so that you know, that it's fairly hot off the press. To kind of give you a picture of in the PowerPoint on page 4, there's a logic model. And basically that tells you everything in the neatest, tidiest summary that I could provide for you. That the problems that we are looking at are youth mental health, youth delinquency, and school performance. And the problems that we're addressing are any use of youth alcohol or any substances, youth depression and anxiety, and what we've seen an uptick of in response to an uptick in depression and anxiety in our youth is suicide ideation. So planning, having a suicide plan, and actually attempting suicide all have gone up. This is a countywide trend. This is a statewide trend. This is a national trend. Part of it may be that we are doing a better job of helping our youth recognize anxiety and depression. But also there's a lot of glamour and sexiness around suicide. 13 Reasons Why is a perfect example of a media. Anybody can watch it on Netflix for free. We predicted that with glamorizing suicide, there might be more youth doing it, and there was a national research study that has just said that. After 13 Reasons ran its 13 series sessions, suicide rates did go up. After they ran their second series last year, suicide rates across the nation went up. And last week they just released season 3. And if I look blurry-eyed, it's because I watched the 13, because I need to know what they're putting out there. And what's coupled with the anxiety, depression, and bully issues around our youth is guns in the school and shooting. And so the second season of 13 Reasons Why, that started out with the main voice being a young lady who has committed suicide because she's been raped and bullied. The second season rolls into a school shooting because of rape and bullying. And the third season deals with the aftermath. The youth were able to talk down the potential perpetrator, but I look at that series and think they're looking at putting a lot of the weight of peer-to-peer management of these potential issues that can happen, whether it's suicide or gun shootings in the school. So for me, I'm leaving watching that very concerned that we have a lot of work still to do with our youth and families on helping our youth know that as parents and caregivers and as school adults and community adults, there are many people in the community ready to help youth, and that all of the onus cannot be on friends. And we are actually measuring that through the Help the Youth survey data. I don't have that data for you, but we do ask the youth, when you have an issue or have a problem, substance abuse or being bullied, who do you go to? And they can tick a list of whether it's someone in the family, someone in the school, or if it's a friend. And what we do see in our data is after ninth grade, the shift moves from family or school professionals to friends. So cutting across the domains of community, school, peers, community, and family, That is our work. How do we build skills and knowledge across all of those areas? So our logic model basically shows what we do in the schools, what we do with the Family Resource Center to reach out to families, and what work we do directly with kids in a kind of a crossover of all of the domains. So before I go specifically into strengthening families, which is both for youth and for the parents or caregivers, I just wanted to ask you to take a look at page 6, and I'm just going to very quickly reference some of the data that I felt was important to share with you for trends. So we're looking at slides. I have these on half page. So it looks like slide 11, starting on slide 11. And in your packet, it would be page 6. So you would see a page that looks like this. Okay. Do you need an extra? I have an extra one.
Sure.
There you go. Make it easier for you. So grade 10 across the nation is our target older youth group. We do collect data for grade 12 where we actually see higher use, but the most consistent baseline is grade 8 and grade 10 as where we're hoping to see things go down. So I wanted to use grade 10 as far as self-report use. What does that look like? And so we have the trends from 2004 to 2018, and this youth takes a self-reporting survey every mid-October, and that has occurred since 2002. We actually have data going all the way back to 2002. We actually had to kind of tick things along. So across the x-axis, you can see we're looking at cigarettes over time, and the good news is that cigarette use is below 10%. So it's looking at about 8% right now, a little bit lower last year. So note that the y-axis only tops out at 45, just so you can read the graph. So we're way below 20% of the past. Similarly, with alcohol, our peak was up to about 42% with youth, and we're down to 24% over the decade. That represents a 41% decrease, which is commendable, and we're thrilled about that because our typical biggest bump up was between 8th grade and 10th grade. What had been our growing concern when we started having the campaigns to legalize marijuana for recreational use was the social norming message to youth was, with the legalization of recreational marijuana, it was a more healthy substance to use than alcohol and tobacco. So it had become the drug of choice. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing over the past two survey periods of 2016 and 2018, though we had that spike, it's appearing to settle down, and we're seeing that statewide. Nationally, everyone, if we were to say what's the most problematic substance right now, I think everybody can talk about the opioid crisis, which has predominantly been among the adult population. Our target are up to 18-year-olds, so our funding is to focus on youth. So we look at our data, and this is, again, consistent across San Juan County, but if we look at Snohomish County or King County, Seattle area, typically in the higher density city areas, we're seeing more of the opioid crisis among the youth. But you'll see for our 10th graders, 2018, we have 2% of our youth in 10th grade reporting, and similarly we saw this for grade 12, I can tell you that. And when we look at all other drugs, that includes what most people think of as meth, and some of the other synthetic marijuana type drugs, 10th graders reported zero. And similarly, we had about 2% among our grade 12 youth. So we are not facing that crisis among our youth. Are there a few youth that we have identified? Yes, and we are working with them. But interestingly enough, our most threatening drug right now is nicotine via vaping. So just now, very quickly, I gave you trend lines. So each line is a grade level, and I chose to give you the table as well instead of leave it behind the graph. So if you're a table person, you can get a sense. But again, what I can point out is that cannabis use appears to be trending down, and we'll see where that sits in 2020 when we do our next healthy use survey. So on the next page, the slide shows where we are with combustible cigarettes, which had peaked up in around 2010, 2012. Again, we're on trend with the nation, where we have seen tobacco go down, and thanks to the tobacco settlement, we were able to provide a lot of interventions and a lot of cessation support for youth, and kids really get it, that it's harmful. However, the message has not translated over into the vaping world. So this is our biggest challenge right now, because we also know, besides the high potential of nicotine addiction, they're also putting THC compounds, opioid compounds, into little oil cocktails that taste like watermelon and bubble gum and all kinds of tutti-frutti types of things. We can have like a mocha cocktail. So more to come on that. And part of this comes in educating the community, the parents, and not only the children of what the dangers are. There's no research behind it right now, so all we can do is count the deaths of people as they're occurring right now, because there is absolutely nothing that has been measured about the impact of vaping. So we essentially gave the tobacco companies a pretty good head start when we ratcheted things back for the combustible cigarettes. I think we didn't look at what might be the unintended consequences. So the two things that went on is they ratcheted up their vaping products and distribution, and they've been ratcheting up their marijuana products and distribution. It's been over a decade since they already had put in their patents for their products. So more to come on that. When our coalition started in 2002, flipping to the next page, our priority was alcohol. We had a lot of accidents and crashes occurring, both youth and adult. Again, happy to say at some point it was concerning 2010, 2012 that we had 50% or more of our high school seniors reporting the use of alcohol, and we've been able to bring that down to 27% and 24%. So again, we're looking at over a 40% reduction of alcohol, but it is being replaced by marijuana. The other caveat is that we are not able to do question-by-question analysis to say, are the same kids that are using alcohol using marijuana and vaping. But the state is able to do that, as well as we can do our regional data, which is the five North Sound counties, includes Island, Whatcom, Skagit, and Snohomish. And we are able to do analysis of that, and we found as a region, we align with the state that typically 80% of the kids that are drinking alcohol are also doing the other drugs. So the users are polydrug users. A final trend on alcohol which is really important for us to look at on page 8, the bottom graph, it shows us 3 things that they ever tried alcohol, and then we look at their current use. And what we do want to see is that big gap between that top line and the middle line, and we really would love to see the binge drinking line below that totally flattened down, because that's where EMS and hospital emergency room have to start stepping in. And primarily, I think we have found the success around educating youth about what to do when a friend has had too much to drink. Versus leave them alone. So next, page 9, I just wanted to share with you that we are very cognizant that every grade of children cohort looks a little bit different. And I think this graph makes it very clear when we look at the cohorts, what you're looking at is, if we look at the 2011, these are the kids that graduated in June 2011. As sixth graders, 3% of the cohort reported alcohol. As eighth graders, 14%. And figure there's about 60 to 70 kids per class. As 10th graders, they were up to 41%. And then when they graduating year, they were up to 52%. We can go down now to the 2019 class that we just graduated, 2% grade 6, 3% grade 8. So we were able to delay onset of use, which is what we focus on. Grade 10, 24%, and then a slight jump, which would be 2 or 3 kids in their senior year, up to 27%. So what we work on is raising the perception of harm, because we know the primary correlate is if youth, parents, and community members understand what the harm of the drug is, and kids perceive that their use is harmful, then they will not use. If they perceive that it is not harmful, which is the issue that we're having with recreational cannabis, they will use it and feel that if their parents and grandparents are using it intergenerationally, it's become part of a subculture here in the islands, for sure. So strengthening families, why do we do it? We do it because the risk factor that was identified for our community was poor family management, meaning that parents don't have the skills to be parents, to navigate the growth of their preteens and their teens. So what we do is bring in the children and the parents, and the children get trained for an hour while the parents are getting trained for a while, and then we bring them all together. And then they go home and practice their skills. So each session is pre and post assessment. They learn how to talk to each other. The children learn how to recognize their own anxieties and stress, and how can they express that to their parent, and how can the parent who might be frustrated, rather than yelling at the child, asking them what's bothering them and how might they help. So it is skill development. Recommended size of a group is from 4 families to no more than 12 families. For the families that we've been serving, when we did 6 families, we had 4 of those families. Both parents came, as well as having 2 children in the 10 to 14 year range. So that was 4 children. Four person families times 4 was 16 people, and then we had 2 parents that was a single parent with 1 child. And then in the child care, which we provide, There were at any time 12 to 16 children from newborn infants up to age 9. So we had about 32 people that we were actually serving as the whole family. So the next session coming up, we are already marketing it for it to begin in September. We feel that was our weakest link the last two sessions, in that there are still many parents who think that strengthening families is only for people who get a family resource center, a low socioeconomic support, or if they have been sent near suspension at school. This is a universal strategy. We're offering it to all families, all parents, all guardians of children from 10 to 14. And we feel the schools are better on board for helping us promote that this really is for everyone. And our hope is to offer, if this session goes really well and we do find additional funding, that we may consider a spring session as well. Right now we feel the fall session works good because we catch parents fresh in the school year, and we can promote it when the parents come in for that opening of school year. So I did provide you the very last page of your packet. On the back is basically the same budget I have given you for the last 2 years, because it is pretty much a fixed budget as far as what it costs us to pay the facilitators, the amount of time it takes for the facilitators to do the prepping for each session, and it also includes what I am asking of the facilitators, that they actually go out into the community as well and invite personally one or two families to come, so that they themselves are making that personal connection and invitation to families that they may be working with in another role. We did receive a supplemental grant from the state that funds the coalition that I coordinate. That's a July to September. Funds have to be spent then, so we're running all of the materials, creating all the family packets, all the kid packets, and paying the staff for all the preparatory work and the marketing work for that. And then we also have another $2,500 in our budget for the October through June portion of it for follow-up. So the funding that you have provided in the past, the $5,000, rounds it out, so we totally meet our budget. So that's all I have on the budget. Flipping back one page, I wanted to give you a sample of what the Healthy Youth Survey looks like, how we get the trend data. We also get every single question broken down, but this is a nice example of a fact sheet that shows the grade 10 trends in that upper right-hand corner. Gives you the number. Also shows, if we look across to alcohol, it says 24%. Plus or minus 12, it gives us a good sense of what's the confidence interval for our smaller number population. So like the hospital data, because we're a small community with small class size, we have to be really careful how we look at our data from year to year. And then the vaping fact sheet, I gave you a grade 10 fact sheet, so you can get the blurb of what the state is putting out into the community, and it also gives some examples of state comparison data. So I want to thank you, and I There's a lot of information in the PowerPoint. If you want to dig deeper into it, I love to walk and talk. I love to do coffee or tea meetings. Yes. So at any time you want more information or have any questions, I'm available. Any questions?
Yeah. Are you signing up for a walk? Is that what you're doing right now?
No, she's going to buy the coffee.
We did get one.
Yeah, but are they going to walk and drink coffee?
Yeah. I don't know.
No, well,
they shouldn't do that.
Walking and drinking coffee at the same time.
It's possible. I think that with Jennifer Armstrong.
I have two questions.
Sure.
One is, what percentage, if you put out 1,000 surveys, just take that as, what percentage have you been getting back of the surveys you put out?
Yes.
Completed.
That's an excellent question, and I do have a whole table of that for every grade level. Our percentage of response ranges between 70% and 94%, all of which make that reliable data. My first year as a coordinator, when I looked at how many kids had taken the survey, that was 2006, what I discovered was there was kind of a negative attitude around kids lie on the survey, it's a waste of time for them to come out of class, so parental thoughts around it and teachers' thoughts and administrative thoughts, it all bleeded down to the kids. So we had rates of like 42 to 50% of the kids actually taking the surveys. So in my mind, that wasn't our best data in the 2004, 2006. So we really worked around attitude and citizenship and the importance of providing good confidential information. So we're very proud to have the school staff as a partner and positively advocating it, that we do have high percentages. And all of our percentages are higher than the state of respondents, participants.
And is there an objective observable standard to measure a self-reporting survey?
I'm going to ask you what you
if you have a self-report, self-reporting surveys are, in my profession, are
suspect.
They're suspect.
So you.
And is there an objective standard to show that that survey is actually showing what it says it's showing?
Yes. So you. If you could probably understand some of the things that are explained on the Healthy Youth Survey website for Washington State, but it does explain their entire protocol and systems, reliability, validity, standards. So my level of expertise is to trust that this survey...
That they know what you're trusting the state to know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The Healthy Youth Survey for Washington State was piloted in 1998 and rolled off the blocks. And so it was piloted as the Alpha in 1998, Beta in 2000, and then rolled off the blocks in 2002. And then it's just been the participation rate has been growing across the state because it's become mandatory if we want to receive state or federal funding. Yep. And it is aligned, I have that for you. I think I have the links. If you go into the live PowerPoint at slide number 10, you can go into the Ask HYS, and the Department of Health has a much more detailed scientific healthy use survey information. But it is aligned with the Monitoring the Future survey out of Minnesota, and that is done annually since 1977. So some pretty amazing national data. So our questions, when people go, oh, you need to reword that question, or we need to add that question, I'm on the review work group for the state, and a lot that we talk about is we will lose our trend data if we start changing questions, and we'll lose our comparable value comparisons to the monitoring the future if we start mucking around with it too much. So part of the work is educating the community on what we can and can't do in order to keep the survey data reliable. So I trust him because I'm told to. I'll be honest with you.
I got it.
Yeah. Any other questions from the board? Dr. Mark?
Yes, one. What's the percentage of parents that, and families that attend the Strengthening Families program?
So the Strengthening Families program, so one of the handouts that came, that gives, it's like a 12-page overview of Strengthening Families. Again, the recommended size of the training is 10 to 12. So we've only done 3 cohorts from 6 to 8. So I haven't broken it down by percentages, but it's offered to a low percentage. And we haven't been able to bring it up to 12 yet. So we did Strengthening Families way back 2006 to 2010. I worked with Joyce Sobel at the Family Resource Center. We ran a English and then a Spanish. And after 3 years of running it at full capacity of 12, we weren't able to get more than 2 or 3 families. So we feel like we kind of hit that niche of 10 to 14. Now we're trying to build up positive attitude towards family management is something that every parent needs, rich or poor, problem child or regular child. Same thing with our early learning programs is it's for everybody. We aren't born knowing how to manage a family, how to raise a child. So we're trying to make it stigma-free. So I don't have a percentage answer, but I'd say it's very low, probably 5%.
I was just going to ask, is there a need for any kind of funding for Hispanic families? Because that's something that Peace Health has been asked to do, and that's something that maybe they can have some funding for. I don't know if there's something specific.
Yes, there is. So the reason our cost is higher per series is because we do pay for a trained Spanish-speaking facilitator. Because we want the group to be both Spanish and English-speaking families, and so we do have materials in Spanish, and we do have the Spanish-speaking facilitator there at all times. Yeah, so if there's something that helps to support that as a partner, it would be highly welcome.
Good.
We work with UB.
Yeah.
She's staff with the Family Resource Center and the Health Department. So she's our Spanish person and actually was contracted by the Lopez Island Family Resource Center. So our coalition in San Juan took the lead, but we have also share cost the trainings that we brought to the county with the Lopez Family Resource Center and the Orcas Funhouse. So part of my work is county coordination, and so that work is countywide systems development. And whatever we're able to do well here on San Juan Island benefits the county, which in turn, again, rolls back into benefiting the island. So I thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Any further comments or questions from the board? I'd like to proffer a motion, and that is we continue our tradition of. Do you have a comment?
No, I'm getting ready to second your motion.
You haven't even heard my motion.
I haven't said second yet.
You don't need it here. Oh, okay. That we continue our tradition of granting $5,000 on a yearly basis in the name of Salmon Island Prevention Coalition's Strengthening Families program, which seems to be very efficacious. Can I hear a second?
Second.
Very good. Thank you. Discussion?
Yes, I wish we had more money.
Would there be any advantage of in the Hispanic population of you coming back in 3 months and throwing those costs out to us? If there's an extraordinary cost there for an interpreter, and my feeling is that that's important. In fact, I would think two interpreters are important because of the social bias of just one. Mm-hmm. I would like to hear back from you about a supplement to this. Okay. And a justification for
it. Okay. That's sort of a sidebar.
Attorneys
use. Dr. Mark, do you have a comment, sir?
No comments.
Are there comments?
Just call to express appreciation for all the work you're doing.
Yeah.
And no doubt you could use additional funding to advance your programs. It's meritorious. It's meeting needs of the community. Every taxpayer benefits. So thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you. I only caught in the cost-benefit analysis section of that 12-page excellence in prevention that we need to share is that it mentions $119,000 is the cost of one alcohol intervention program. So if we're spending $1,000 on a family that has two teenagers and one of those kids doesn't have to have an intervention, we have saved so much money.
Right.
I mean, they boil it down to $5,000 per person, but that $120,000 intervention, and I believe that was probably based on that community.
Yes, every taxpayer benefits the money that's directed to your organization.
And I think that's the part we need to do a better job of. People really still do not understand prevention, saving money down the road in so many ways for treatment.
Yeah, I think that's a strong basis of continue to support this program. Cost savings, you brought that up somewhere along this in the literature you shared with us, but I was really impressed with that. So, in any event, call for a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Passes unanimously. I won't be here next year, but I hope the 2020 board will invite you back.
Thank you very much.
There's one gentleman in the back, and he's shaking his head up and down. So you have one out of five votes, perhaps. Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you. I'm going to stay for Lainey, because she's on the coalition. So.
Or are you next, Lainey?
Oh,
I thought you were last.
We're going to wait to the very end, but okay.
No, we had a change in the agenda.
Are they joking you?